You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, I will be talking with David Cutler, one of the co-authors for Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in the Age of Isolation. One of our great urbanists and one of our great public health experts joined forces to reckon with how cities are changing in the face of existential threats the pandemic has only accelerated. Cutler is the Otto Eckstein Professor of Applied Economics in the Department of Economics and Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University.
And I'm Liz Old. In the last part of the hour, I will be talking with Laura Davis about her latest book, The Burning Light of Two Stars, A Mother-Daughter Story. It tells the story of her dramatic and tumultuous relationship with her mother. Davis is the best-selling author of The Courage to Heal and The Courage to Heal Workbook, which paved the way for hundreds and thousands of women and men to heal from the trauma of sexual abuse. In her lengthy career as a communicator, she has been a columnist, a talk show host, and a radio news reporter. All this and more, so stay tuned for Right on Radio.
I'm speaking today with David Cutler, one of the co-authors for the book Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation. He's the Otto Eckstein Professor of Applied Economics in the Department of Economics at Harvard University. His work in health economics and public economics has earned him significant academic and public acclaim. Welcome to Right on Radio.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
So Edward Glaser, he's the other author of this book, has published extensively on cities and their evolution over the last 30 years. At the beginning of this book, both of you admitted to having differences in political histories. One is an East Coast Republican, and the other, yourself, has engaged with Democratic health policy for decades. Yet both of you made compromises about policy decisions in this book. What issue was the most difficult for you to reach a resolution on?
You know, it's interesting because someone once said that there's no Democratic or Republican way to clean the cities, to clean the streets. In many ways, what we're dealing with here are a number of technical issues about how do you keep people safe? How do you make communities work? And so I would say, when you put aside politics, like capital P politics, and you get into, you know, how can you make a city work and help it address things? What we found is that there's a lot more agreement. So for example, take one thing that we look at, which is policing, where, you know, we've told the police for decades, keep the streets safe. And then that's happened, that is, streets are much safer, but of course not if you're African-American or someone who looks suspicious or looks unusual, in which case your civil rights are being violated, more likely to be violated. And so, you know, the parties have very different views. But when you think about it, when we sort of sat and talked about it, we said, look, what we both agree is that there's not one mission. It's not a seesaw, like you can either be safe or you can respect people's constitutional rights, but that we need both from the police. And therefore, telling the police departments around the country, do one or the other, is not right, because it's going to make people unhappy, but do both. And they will say, correctly, we need more resources to do both. And we'll say, fine, we'll give you the resources, but we have to be sure that we're going to get these outcomes. So we're going to have to measure and monitor and do surveys and things like that. And so in the end, it becomes an issue not of politics. That is, I've been more associated with the left and there's no sort of defund the police. And Ed has been more associated with the right and there's been no the book doesn't have a lot of, you know, this is just the way it has to be. And, you know, stop and frisk was a great thing, which we explicitly say was not. It's really about how do you take your desire to do good socially and your desire to, and the constraints that you have to do to do the best that you can. And that's really where we met on this is, you know, how do you turn what are difficult problems into workable solutions?
So I want to delve into that more. In the book, you refer to a Pandora's box of urban woes that threaten city life: expensive housing, conflicts over gentrification, low levels of social mobility, racially targets policing, and so on. What is the common root for these disparate issues?
The most common is that many, not all, but many of them are issues of insiders versus outsiders, where, you know, if you think about police, you know, people who are insiders who have nice houses and nice neighborhoods and so on want safety, and they obviously have a right to safety. And the outsiders, those who are minority groups, African-Americans who traditionally haven't fit in or so on, are sort of then the ones who get the short end there. And the schools, those who need special attention in schools can get the short end. And with housing prices, you know, people who are there like pretty views and small quiet streets and you know, lots of open space. And that means that outsiders can't afford to live in an area. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these are conflicts between insiders and outsiders. And unfortunately, in many areas, occupational licensing is another, you know, certainly for some occupations, you need some minimum set of skills. But, you know, why is it that in Massachusetts, you had to be a nurse licensed in Massachusetts? You couldn't be a nurse licensed in Minnesota and work in Massachusetts until the pandemic? Is it really that the nurses in Minnesota are trained so much worse than the nurses in Massachusetts that we have to make you get a license? That's all just insiders protecting themselves from outsiders. And societies don't work when they're insiders that are protecting themselves against outsiders. That's not That cities are a great avenue of upward mobility. And if you're going to sort of pull the drawbridge over the moat, you're not going to have that.
So this is a call to action, remaking a system built for insiders into an area for empowering outsiders. What are the measures necessary to make that possible then?
To some extent, it's going to have to happen through the public sector. It's going to have to be a public sector thing. Just to take a few examples, zoning policies are determined at local levels and at state levels. We're all in favor of making sure that what we're doing passes cost effectiveness, cost benefit criteria. That is, that the benefits exceed the costs. But you can't not do it just because some people don't want to do it, even independent of that. So getting rid of things that arbitrarily say insiders get to do what they want at the expense of outsiders and saying, no, we're going to decide on a cost benefit criteria what is the best way to do it. So that's a very clear example. Other things, like, for example, Congress may soon pass an infrastructure bill. Well, there's no reason why the benefits of that spending shouldn't go more to areas where infrastructure is going to benefit more people. So we should develop infrastructure more in areas that are more hospitable to people moving in, especially to people who are not traditionally insiders who are looking to move in or get started in a place. So those are things that where we ought to think about the benefits of legislation that we do as targeting them to people. So all of those, same is true. So that's about, you know, education policy and housing policy. Same is true of medical care, where we have to think about the medical care system and say, you know, what we've learned from pandemic is that we're only as a society, we're only as healthy as the least healthy people. Because otherwise, you know, people who are less healthy are going to catch pandemic disease more, and then that's going to spread to all of us. So we have to then invest in the health of everywhere in the community. So, and that's going to be a federal and a local and a state and an international effort. So I think all of those areas are going to have to be involved.
So there's a ripple effect that happens when serious sweeps of progressive change occur. And you give the example in the book of how in the 1960s, cities acted like Robin Hood to the less fortunate. Would be no different now in defunding the police, resulting in wealthier city dwellers to uproot for safer suburbs if crime rates would start to rise. And this would ultimately affect the poor and the vulnerable the most. If this happens, we will see a decline of cities and instead enclaves. The line I have in my notes here is that it'd be a world in which enclaves replace cities is a world impoverished. I don't think there's a perfect solution to this, but what is the best solution?
So we have observed that we've observed two things. One is, if there's a lot of crime in city, then higher income, middle income people move out and there goes your tax base. And second is that if you have high taxes without showing that the taxes are going for something valuable, people will also move out. So both of those can happen. The solution, I think, has got to be, we need both safety and civil rights. So we need both of those. And that will require more money. And so societies will, cities will be going to higher income people and saying, we need more money. But the key has to be, I'm going to show you what you're going to get for it. And you are actually going to get something for it. So we are going to get safety. We're still going to be a very safe place. In fact, we'll continue to be, we're going to continue to work on safety. And we're not going to have people who feel like they're being harassed and who are being harassed. So it's going to be both of those. And the city is going to be a better place for everyone. Now, why does that work for you as a business? Because you need your employees to be comfortable. You need your customers to be comfortable. You need yourself to be comfortable and all of that. So therefore, that's how this is going to work for you. And so we're all in this together and we need to make this work together. And that's, I think, going to be what my hope is, the way this happens, is that everyone agrees there are things we want and we're going to have to pay more for some of those, but we're going to be absolutely very clear about how we're going to measure it and ensure that we get that. Other things, by the way, we're wasting money. Like in medical care, we're wasting a ton of money. And so there we should be spending a lot less, even as we get more.
Most people who have been afflicted with COVID have survived. However, many survivors suffer long-term impairments like respiratory disease, cardiac disease, and other complications. How is this similar to cities? Maybe a better way to ask this would be, what will be the long-term effects following the way in the wake of the pandemic?
Yeah, so it is quite similar for a city. Cities can sort of have their own lives. I think some cities will do fine, the biggest cities, you know, the New Yorks and San Franciscos and LAs and so on, because there's such demand for living there. What I worry about are the cities where businesses are mobile and people are mobile and there's not much keeping people there. So you could have a couple of big employers move out and then all of a sudden people move out and city tax revenues go down and then the city can't afford to provide services and more people leave and it becomes a spiral. And we saw that in a number of cities in the 1970s and 80s and up through the 90s. And then, of course, there was this huge desire to be back in cities again, and lots of cities did very well. So I worry about those cities. And I think the solution, you know, it's not, unlike COVID, we can actually treat it. And so we can do things to try and prevent it. But what it's going to require is a really good management capacity at the local level to say, we've got these problems, we need to address these problems, but we also can't do it by driving people away. We've got to do it by being inclusive about the problems, about solving the problems. And we know how to do that. So for example, businesses like trained labor. So if you say, how do we train more people so that they're meeting the skill needs of the employers in the area? And how do we set up, you know, markets in the area so that it works and transportation systems in the area so that it works? So that all of those are things that we can do that benefit people and the firms that are in those areas.
An interesting fact many people don't consider with the differences of political opinions between city dwellers and rural residents is that urbanites need more government than residents of lower density America. I'm wondering, how would you convince someone living outside the city or beyond the suburbs to care about public management or public policy decisions in cities?
Yeah. So, one of the things about cities is that people recognize the need for government much more, you know, just from everyday things about, you know, how do you get the sewers working and the water system working and so on? You know, there's just this intimate relationship with government. I think there are things for which people in rural areas do actually want more government, or they need government to help. So let me take a clear example of that, which is medical care is much less, high-tech medical care is much less available in rural areas than in urban areas. And yet there's no reason why we can't have a broadband link from urban areas to rural areas to pick, you know, so that if people need more sophisticated care, that can at least be on the line rather than even if not in person fully. That's going to require government to help it out because only the government is going to be able to build the broadband capacity and set up the system infrastructure and payment models and all of that to make that work. So my sense is that there are things for which there is demand, but people don't know to demand it of government because it hasn't traditionally been seen as a government thing, but it's actually quite important. I think also in the COVID-19 space, thinking about how do we prevent pandemic disease worldwide? is again something that people, even outside of urban areas, you know, COVID-19 does not discriminate. It spreads more when people are in close contact, but it's certainly not spared rural areas of the country. And so that's another thing for which thinking about the global response to pandemic is something where government is important, even if one has an aversion to government in principle.
By your estimation, COVID-19 will cost the U.S. economy $16 trillion once it's done. You believe it's worth to potentially spend billions to avoid future pandemics. And I think that's a good idea. I was just wondering, how do we ensure it's spent effectively?
So that's always a worry. So one of the worries always is when you spend money, you know, are you doing it effectively? One of the interesting things that's happened is our ability to monitor what goes on has actually improved. So for example, you know, we were talking about, you know, police. We can now monitor what police are doing all the time in real time with cameras and things that we didn't used to be able to do. So we can observe more about what happens when low-income minority populations interact with police than we were ever able to do in the past. Similarly, at the global level, we have knowledge about various possible pandemic threats and actual threats in different areas. So we could set up organizations and say, for many of them, not all, but for many of them, we can monitor how things are going. So one of the basic tenets of economics, of economic management, is that if you don't measure something, you never work at it. You know, what you work at what you measure. So anything for which we really want something different and better to happen, we're going to have to measure it and say, this is a part of what we're going to look at. And are we getting to where we want or not? And if not, how do we change things so that we do?
You suggest establishing a multinational anti-pandemic agency to monitor for new outbreaks. How would you propose building this NATO for public health?
Yeah. So what we propose is something that looks like NATO, or at least is inspired by NATO. NATO is probably the most successful international alliance of certainly our lifetime. It's what's interesting about it is, at least from our perspective, it was given a very clear mission and a budget that was appropriate to that mission, and that wasn't that, and the budget like doesn't depend each year on whether you said nice things or not. So the mission was to prevent the West from attack by the Soviet Union. That was the mission. And obviously, if there was an attack, it would have been a failure to prevent it. But you can also, you know, you then say, okay, look, we're going to give you this mission. We're going to give you this budget. Now we want to see the performance on it. I think for a global health organization, in some ways, it may even be a little bit easier because you can monitor things like, are you taking the steps that the world has identified to reduce the risk of pandemic disease? I think what's really going to have to happen is that the rich countries will have to get together just like they did with NATO and say, we are going to pay for it because we have to pay for it because that's the only place where the money is going to come from. We're going to pay for it, but it's not just a blank check. Here's what we insist on, and here's how we're going to monitor it. And then make it be not a political issue about you need to be nice to these people and not nice to these people, but make it be a scientific issue, which is what are the things we need to do? And are you, global community, going to do them or not? You know, how are we going to get them done? And they're then going to be consequences if they're not met. So a country like, for example, if China, you know, if you need to reduce wet markets and things and that's not done, then there are consequences. Because you just can't have access to the world in the same way if you're at risk of spreading pandemic disease. So that's, I think, the part of the rules of the road that are going to have to be laid down, just like there were rules of the road that were laid down with respect to preventing nuclear war. And pandemic disease is, if anything, more complex than nuclear war, and we devote less attention to it.
I think that's a really good point. You discuss in the book how defunding the police won't accomplish anything. It will neither make more safety nor more respect within the community with poor police departments. The answer would be not defunding, but defining the mission of police to include crime reduction and upholding civil rights. This means paying more for policing, correct?
It does mean paying more for policing. You know, as economists, you get what you pay for. And if you want an organization to do something different than what it's doing, if you want it to do what it's doing now and then more, you need to put in the resources to make that happen. So there's no way you can say, I want you to do more with less. I mean, you know, unless you can identify what that less is that you, mm-hmm. you know, that thing that you don't want them to do is. So realistically, we're going to have to say to the police across the country, we want safety and we want civil rights. We're going to monitor them. Here's how we're going to monitor them. We understand that costs more and we're going to put more in. And that's just the way it is. And if we want to have that, that's how we're going to be.
A large focus of your research was on those affected by COVID-19 were those who lived in colored lower income communities. I was wondering if you could talk about the reasons for this.
Yeah. So unfortunately, those that were hit the worst were those people of color, people in low income communities, people in high density areas. There are, you know, different layers of answers to why, you know, so on the one hand, it's because obesity rates are higher in lower income populations and obesity is a risk factor for COVID. And living in dense housing is a risk factor and low income people are more likely to live in dense housing. And taking the subway or the bus to work is a risk factor and low income people are more likely to take the subway or bus to work. So on the one hand, there are sort of those events that way. On the other hand, I think that's also too simple of an explanation in the sense that we observe those health differences about not just COVID, but everything. So everything, you know, health across the board is worse for low income than for high income people and for racial minorities compared to racial majorities. So it's not fair just to say it's COVID, that we have to address all of these racial issues in society.
America has built a public health insurance system that spends $3 trillion annually on medical care. However, it wasn't able to build a system to fully protect and promote the health of the public. In one part of the book, you mentioned that the focus of healthcare systems for nearly all world governments focus on individual care over public health. However, all developed countries, with the exception of the U.S., have universal health insurance. Healthcare is sick in this country. How do you think we should help it?
Healthcare is sick in this country. Of course, we knew that before COVID. What we didn't know before COVID is that it was unprepared to do much in a pandemic either. There are a couple of different ways to think about it, but the way I would put it primarily is that healthcare in this country is basically designed as a private healthcare system to pay the bills, help you pay the bills when you get sick. So that's its mission, is private insurance to help pay the bills when you get sick. And what we need is a system that is focused around the public healthcare issue of keeping all Americans as healthy as we can be for as long as we can be, and doing so at the lowest cost it can. And that's a very different mission, and it involves different funding structures and different system organization and different goals on the part of providers and so on. And so we're going to have to move that. One part of that is going to be that everyone has to have insurance coverage, because you can't have a system where people are afraid, as many people were, of going to the doctor for COVID because maybe I can't afford it. Thank God we made it free, even though then some people didn't go. So the insurance coverage is going to have to be a part of it, but it's still going to require much more than that. It's not going to be, once people have insurance, it's still, you know, what we observed is that even with insurance had difficulty accessing medical care in the best way for COVID. And they still had difficulty, we still have difficulty getting contact tracing and isolation and testing, wide scale testing and so on. And so there's going to be no alternative to thinking about taking a healthcare system that's devoted to helping pay the bills and keep the medical system afloat when we're sick, and taking that and saying, no, we really, really need to focus on the population health as well.
And my last question for you, I believe, you bring up a concern in the book about the future of cities following COVID. Many people are opting to work at home since it was possible during the pandemic. What will happen to downtowns if people and businesses conclude it's cheaper and more productive to have people work from home and telecommunicate for all their company needs?
So I think some companies will reduce their footprint. They won't need as many people in at the same time, and they will take up less space. I think in some cases that will be difficult, particularly if there's not much demand for being in the city, and therefore that reduces the total amount of activity in the city and tax revenues and so on. For a lot of cities, there may be some unexpected benefits. I can think of two. One is young startups that have been priced out of the market because rents are too high. So those people may now say, oh, gee, I can start a new business. You know, the space isn't so tight. I can think about a new business or a new opportunity somehow. And so that's part of what may happen. And that would be good. That would be good in a lot of ways. The other thing that may happen is that some commercial land could get turned into residential land. And in a lot of areas of the country, rents are too high and they haven't been able to build enough and build enough new housing and so on. And so that could be great, particularly for low-income people, for younger people who want to live in cities, who don't care about that much space, who just want, you know, a chance to do stuff and get ahead and are finding themselves priced out of a lot of cities. This could really help them a lot. So I think that taking some use away from suburbans and established businesses into kind of scrappier, younger starting up things could be very good, assuming that the city can sustain that and that it's not just going to be a depopulation of the city.
We are out of time, but you've been listening to my conversation with David Cutler. He's one of the co-authors of the new book, Survival of the City, Living in an Age of Isolation. Thank you for your time, David.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And now this.
Laura, are you there?
Yes.
Great. Hi, Laura. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great.
Oh, that's great. Tonight, we're going to be speaking with Laura Davis, author of The Burning Light of Two Stars and many other books that you'll be familiar with as we talk. But let's start with a little introduction to the book, a little synopsis, and a reading that you prepared.
Okay, so The Burning Light of Two Stars tells the story of my embattled relationship with my mother, our determination to love one another, and the dramatic and surprising collision course we ended up on at the end of her life. When I was in my 20s, my mother and I experienced a terrible rift, and we spent the next 20 years struggling to find our way back to each other. And I thought that we had reconciled. But then my mother grew old, and she called one day to announce that she was moving across the country to live in my town for the rest of her life. And suddenly, we no longer had a 3,000-mile buffer between us, and she began losing her mind to dementia. And her decline triggered every button I had. How could it not? She'd made those buttons. And caring for her brought up all the issues that had never been resolved between us, but I had made a promise to care for her for the rest of her life. And so this memoir, my story, describes what happened next. Despite everything, was I capable of becoming the daughter she needed me to be? Could I find it in my heart to love her unconditionally? The piece I chose to read is a little bit after my mother has arrived in California. She's living across town from me. We're kind of at war over her independence, which often happens when a parent has dementia. She felt she could take care of herself. I felt she wasn't safe. And I was going through the motions of being a good daughter. I was doing all the tasks and things I needed to do, but there still was such a wall between us. And one day I went to see her. I was helping her do some things, and she basically confronted me about how cold I was. And this is what I wrote afterwards. 3 decades earlier, I had erected an impenetrable wall between us, a fortress with narrow slits so I could watch her approach. I ensured that my defenses were prepared any time she came near me. I always had an escape plan. It's true, we later reconciled, and the fact that we were able to create a functional relationship was a miracle. But it wasn't an intimate miracle, because I never took down my wall. Oh, I taught myself to be kind to her in a fake it till you make it kind of way. But I still held her at bay. My wall just got subtler. It wasn't permeable. It was hard and opaque, and there was no door. We only met in the antechamber, the common room where guests are received. Only my polished self was on display, my masked self, and only in the antechamber. Mom never saw my inner sanctum, and I never saw hers. I got as close as I could within the constraints I had established, but closed is closed, and a closed heart is a lonely one. The price I paid to keep my mother out, at first with withdrawal, later with an armed fortress, and finally with the polite rules of détente, was love. The pure, unfettered love I longed for, the pure, unfettered love she craved. That day in the kitchen when I couldn't comfort her, I had to face it. My mother was still a stranger to me, with tentacles of need I was loath to touch. I wanted to be more than kind, to do more than merely what was right. I wanted to love my mother, just once, freely and with the relief of a lost, exhausted child, beyond words and beyond all pretense. I wanted to lay my head on a place that was safe, just once, before it was too late.
Thank you. That was a reading from The Burning Light of Two Stars by Laura Davis. Let us talk first about, you have written another book about your relationship with your mother, I Thought We'd Never Speak Again. And I'm wondering how long ago that was, how you changed between the two books, how they're different and how they're the same.
The I Thought We'd Never Speak Again came out 19 years ago, so it's quite a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it's much more of a kind of how-to book about how to reconcile estranged relationships. And for that book, it was inspired by the fact that my mother and I had done a lot of healing in our relationship. But I went out and I interviewed like Vietnam veterans who had gone back to Vietnam. I interviewed people who had used restorative justice. I interviewed all kinds of family scenarios where people had successfully reconciled or not, or had found peace in themselves or with the other person. And so the book really goes through what are the elements of reconciliation. It has lots of other people's stories. And it talks about four different pathways to reconciliation that people can achieve. So it was really a guidebook. And there was a little thread of my story with my mother, but it was, you know, like 2% of 100% of that book. And this story is a memoir. And so it's 100% the story that just was barely hinted at in that book. And, you know, that story, in the first book, it ended when my mother's 70th birthday party, which was kind of a celebratory event. And this story really picks up 10 years later and covers the end of her life and what it meant for me to be a caregiver to someone who had really betrayed me in the past. And, you know, what that, the challenge, the reward, what I had to go through, I really tried to give an honest rendering of being a caregiver, especially when there's this kind of wound also that you're coping with.
Talk some about your relationship with your mother early in your life, and when did it change, and how did it change, and was it a sudden change, or was it gradual?
It was definitely gradual. You know, I think when I was a little girl, my mother was a wonderful mother in many ways. And I think as long as I was kind of a good little girl, you know, when I was a young child, we got along well. But as soon as I began to assert being different from her, you know, kind of in adolescence, early adolescence, I am a very strong personality. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I was a counterculture kid. I dropped out of, you know, the things that she expected me to do. You know, I quit college 3 times. I went into an ashram with a guru. When I was 23, I came out as a lesbian. I did a lot of things that my mother was horrified by. And she felt that I was doing them to spite her. You know, in her mind, it was all to make her, you know, suffer, basically. And so we just, you know, as I started making these choices that she couldn't get behind, and I think I was quite a challenging daughter to have, we just got more and more estranged. You know, when I came out to her, I was 23 years old, and her response was, "You've confirmed my worst fear about you." You know, so it was very hard to be close to someone when that was her response. And then, you know, several years after that, I began to remember that I had been sexually abused as a child by her father, my grandfather. And that when I came forward with that, that was kind of like the final straw, because I desperately needed her support. You know, I was going through the worst crisis in my whole life. And she insisted that I was lying, and she was just as desperate for me to recant and to say it hadn't happened. And so, you know, neither one of us was willing to back down. And then on top of that, I went ahead and ended up writing a best-selling book called The Courage to Heal, which was a guide to healing from child sexual abuse. And it became this underground bestseller. And suddenly, not only was I saying this, but I was on national TV saying it, you know, and I was speaking to giant audiences of women who would come to hear me speak. And so, you know, I went very public with this thing that she was certain had never happened. And that was really the final straw. But I think there'd been a lot of cracks in the relationship before that time. But that really was kind of, that was it.
Talk a little bit.
For a while.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, just, you know, that, you know, we were very bitterly estranged for a number of years. And it was when I had my first child. I had a son when I was 36 years old, that really helped give both of us the impetus to want to really try to work on this relationship and see if there was any way to find common ground. And I would say that his birth, he's 28 now, so I would say his birth was really the beginning of a reconciliation process between us. That was very slow and took many years and had a lot of ups and downs and a lot of walking on eggshells. But, you know, we gradually got closer, but we were able to have kind of, as I described it in that passage, a functional relationship, but not an intimate one.
Let's talk just a tiny bit about the Courage to Heal. Actually, I'm mostly interested in how working on that book informed your work in this book about the healing and about some of the things your mother said to you in regard to not believing you about the abuse. And how did that help you, that you had written that book before? How did that help you get through writing this one?
You know, I don't really know how to answer that. The Courage to Heal was published 33 years ago, mm-hmm. so it was really a long time ago. And I think it definitely, I crossed a line when I published that book in terms of standing up for what I knew to be true. Mm-hmm. And I think, and my mother, you know, couldn't deal with it. And I think, you know, her denial was so typical. I think one of the things that was, I guess, helpful is that having interviewed hundreds of survivors of abuse, you know, family reactions like hers were pretty typical. So, you know, this wasn't unusual. So I think that was helpful. But I think, you know, I have been committed to a healing process my whole life. You know, I'm a person who likes to keep growing. And I think, you know, one of the things that enabled me to begin to reconcile with my mother is that I really committed to the healing work I needed to do. And at a certain point, you know, probably in my mid-30s, I didn't really want to be identified with this terrible thing that had happened in my past. Mm. And I wanted to start asking myself, well, who am I now? Like, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? I've gone to therapy. I've gone to these support groups. I've really, really healed this, you know, or worked on healing it. And now, who do I want to be? I don't want my life to be a reaction to this terrible thing. Who was I meant to be before this ever happened to me? And I really wanted to discover that. And part of that was becoming an author. Part of it was becoming a mother. Part of it was having a family and ultimately becoming a teacher. You know, there's the way I express myself in the world, I think, is probably how I was meant to do. And that the Courage to Heal was the first step in that path of becoming an author.
Boundaries seem very important in this book. Boundaries with your mother and other ways that you want to have a safe space for yourself without other people impeding into it. Talk a little bit about the boundary thing, especially with your mom.
Well, you know, at first I had to create really rigid boundaries, you know, and I think when we've been injured by someone, the first thing we need is we need to create those kind of boundaries so that the injury is not continuing and so that we can perspective, we could do our own healing. It's kind of you create a protective space. But I think as time goes on and you go through that healing process, the boundaries can get softer, you know, and I experienced that with my mother. I think one of the things we did that was really helpful is we agreed to disagree. You know, there was this huge, terrible issue between us that we could not agree on. And we, for years, we were trying to convince each other. You know, I was trying to say I was right and that she was wrong and she was doing the same thing. And I think we both got to the point of realizing, you know, let's leave the unresolved stuff sitting there. And what are the other ways in which we might be able to forge a connection? You know, it's similar. If you have a blockage to your heart and the arteries are blocked, then new capillaries begin to grow so that the blood continues to flow. And so we did that. You know, my mother and I both loved the movies. We both loved theater. So we would go to the movies or we would go to the theater. And one of the things my mother did that I thought was really critical is that we were living 3,000 miles apart. And when I had my son, she began coming to California for a couple of months every winter. So she crossed the country. She would rent her own apartment. And at first I was not very welcoming. You know, I was very ambivalent about her being there, but she would come, she would live her own life, make her own friends, but we would have the opportunity because we were in proximity to start doing things together that would build some new tendrils of connection. And I really give her a huge amount of credit for taking that step. I think it made a really huge difference between us. As she wrote to me one day, she said, you know, if we never see each other, all we're going to have is a really crappy 20 years, the last 20 years, and that we need to start generating some new experiences. So, you know, and I described that process, you know, in great detail in The Burning Light of Two Stars. And then, you know, when she got old, it added a whole other level of complexity when I was caregiving her and when the dynamic of power shifted between us and suddenly I was the one who had control in the relationship. And she needed me. And it was very poignant. It was very challenging. It brought up a lot from the earlier years between us. But I think one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story is I wanted people to understand that sometimes even the most challenging and difficult relationships can reach a place of some kind of peace and resolution. You know, even, you know, I did write a book called I Thought We'd Never Speak Again. And at one point I did think that, you know, but I was at her deathbed and I really wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was a huge shift that happened over that 20 or 30 year period. And I really wanted to document particularly the last 7 years of her life when she came out to California and really write about what does it mean to caretake someone? You mm-hmm. know, what is it like to get old in this country? What is it like to watch someone that you love decline? And, you know, in the midst of, I had teenagers at the time, you know, I was just squeezed in that sandwich generation like so many people are. Mm. And it's a stressful period when you're in that position of caring for so many different people.
Would you say your desired, well, obviously, we always want everybody to read our book, but I'm wondering who you were writing to as you wrote the book and what kinds of messages did you want people to receive from reading this book?
Well, you know, the kind of like the book isn't quite out yet. It was delayed because of, you know, COVID supply chain problems many books right now. So, it'll be coming out November 9th, but I have had some early readers, and I've posted the first 5 chapters up on my website at www.lauradavis.net. And so people have been reading the first 5 chapters and then writing to me. And the kind of feedback I'm getting, people are saying things like, you know, I know I'm going to have to take care of my mother, and I've been dreading it, and now I'm looking at it as an opportunity. You know, or they'll say, you know, I'm thinking about my mother or my daughter in a whole new way. One woman even wrote and said that she picked up the phone and called her mother for the first time in 18 years.
Wow.
So, you know, I think I was writing for people who are experiencing distance or estrangement from any family member who really long for some kind of resolution to that situation. I was writing for anyone who had been healed from sexual abuse who wanted to know, what is it like 30 years later or 40 years later? Like, what is the really long-term picture? So I felt like that was part of the audience. I think it's also, I really worked hard to make it read like a novel. So I think anyone who just likes a well-told story where you have to keep turning pages to find out what's going to happen, I don't think you have to have any of these issues. And I was thinking of people who are caregivers, you know, who are dealing with aging parents,
mm-hmm.
Or aging parents who are having to deal with giving up their independence. So I think for all the, you know, people dealing with death with dignity, anyone who has someone with Alzheimer's or dementia. So there's a lot of potential people I think would find this book meaningful. And I really primarily wrote it as a story, but when people tell me that it's touching them in a deep way, of course, that makes me really, really glad.
Well, your book humanizes people with dementia and Alzheimer's. I think many people just have a idea in their head about what it's like, and they don't really understand. And your book really humanizes people. I got a real deep, deep feeling for your mom and what she was going through, and what you were going through, too. Well, I want to talk a little bit about structure. I found the structure very interesting and really a page turner, as you said. It's not chronological, and sometimes you drop in the story of the letters that you were reading that your mother and you had written to each other over the course, sometimes of this period of time when you were pretty estranged, you still wrote letters to each other. And I'm wondering how you decided to do that structure. What prompted you to do it that way rather than some other way?
Well, I wrestled with the structure for years. I mean, it took me 10 years to write this book. I tried to write it as a play. I tried to write it actually exclusively as a book of letters, as an epistolary memoir. And people told me that they felt like it was a private conversation and they were on the outside. The letters, it's pretty interesting because when my mother died, I found this cache of letters. And she had saved every letter she had ever written to me. She had copied it because this is, you know, pre-internet. She had copied the letters. She had even saved like the first draft of letters that she never sent to me. And I had saved the same.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put together all the letters I had saved and all the letters she had saved, there was this like huge stack of letters. And I kind of dreaded reading them, but I did. I forced myself to sit down and read them. And it was a confrontation because what I discovered was that I had had this storyline that I had told many people for many years about my mother is this way and this is what happened between us. And we didn't speak for 7 years. And then when I read these letters, I saw that we had been corresponding that whole time.
Mm.
And suddenly the story I had been telling began to fall apart. And I saw that this story that I needed to prop myself up was just, it was true, but it was only part of the truth. And when I read these letters, there were definitely letters that were angry and bitter and accusatory, but there were also letters from her that were incredibly loving and generous. And so it was kind of mind-blowing, really, really mind-blowing to read these letters. And I always wanted to include some of them in the book, and almost every editor I worked with told me, get rid of them. It's just like this book is too complicated. You're in the past, you're in the present, you're in the future. Get rid of the letters. But I just insisted, and I pared them down. You know, there's not very many of them left. But I think I'm really glad they're still in there because it's really the only place my mother gets her own voice that is not modulated through my interpretation. You know, it's not my version of what she said to me, but it's actually her real language. And I think it's great that she gets to speak for herself.
We have unfortunately run out of time. I'm enjoying speaking with you. We've been speaking with Laura Davis, author of The Burning Light of Two Stars. And you said once, but why don't you say again how people can reach you?
Yeah, the best way is my website, which is www.lauradavis.net. And if you go there, you could find out, I'm a writing teacher, you could find all about my writing teaching. But I think most importantly to this conversation, I have posted the first 5 chapters of the memoir online for people to read for free. So you could go read it. And, you know, if you want to pre-order it, it's coming out in just a couple of weeks. There's all the buttons where you can buy it. And it will be a nice little gift that will arrive in your mailbox a couple of weeks from now.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been a really enjoyable, wonderful interview. And so we've been speaking with Laura Davis, and we will have to say goodbye at this point. Thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, thanks. And now this.
Yes.
You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, David Cutler and Laura Davis, plus you, our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio on KFAI.org. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota.